said the wrong thing. Susan put her hand over her eyes. Oh, dear.
I said that, said Lobsang, just after we came up the stairs.
He glared at Susan.
Twins, right? I've heard about this sort of thing. What one thinks, the other thinks too.
Susan sighed. Sometimes she thought, I really am a coward.
Something like that, yes, she said. I'm going to see him then, even if he can't see me. Damn, thought Susan, and hurried after Lobsang as he headed along the passage.
Lady Lejeune trailed behind them both, looking concerned. Jeremy was lying on a bed, although it was no softer than anything else in the timeless world. Lobsang stopped and stared.
He looks quite like me, he said.
Oh, yes, said Susan.
Dinner, perhaps?
Could be, yes.
Different lines on his face.
You've led different lives, said Susan.
How did you know about him and me?
My grandfather takes, an interest in this sort of thing. I found out some more by myself, too, she said.
Why should we interest anyone? We're not special.
This is going to be quite hard to explain.
Susan looked around at Lady Lejeune.
How safe are we here?
The signs upset them, said her ladyship. They tend to keep away. I, shall we say, took care of the ones who followed you.
Then you'd better sit down, Mr. Ludd, said Susan. It might help if I told you about me.
Well?
My grandfather is death.
Well, that's a strange thing to say. Death is just the end of life. It's not a person, a...
Pay attention to me when I am talking to you.
A wind whipped around the room, and the light changed. Shadows formed on Susan's face. A faint blue light outlined her. Lobsang swallowed.
The light faded. The shadows vanished.
There is a process called death. And there is a person called death, said Susan. That is how it works. And I am death's granddaughter. Am I going too fast for you?
No.
Although right up until just now you looked human, said Lobsang.
Both my parents were human. There's more than one kind of genetics. Susan paused.
You look human, too. Human is a very popular look in these parts. You'd be amazed. Except that I am human.
Susan gave a little smile that, on anyone less obviously in full control of themselves, might have seemed slightly nervous.
Yes, she said. And then again, no.
No. Take war, now, said Susan, backing away from the point.
Big man, hearty laugh, tends to fart after meals. As human as the next man, you say.
But the next man is death. He's human-shaped, too, and that's because humans invented the idea of ideas, and they think in human shape.
Get back to the and then again no, will you?
Your mother is time.
No one knows who my mother is.
I could take you to the midwife, said Susan. Your father found the best there's ever been.
She delivered you.
Your mother was time.
Lobsang sat with his mouth open.
It was easier for me, said Susan. When I was very small, my parents used to let me visit my grandfather.
I thought every grandfather had a long black robe and rode a pale horse. And then they decided that maybe that wasn't the right environment for a child. They worried about how I was going to grow up.
She laughed mirthlessly.
I had a very strange education, you know. Maths, logic, that sort of thing. And then, when I was a bit younger than you, a rat turned up in my room, and suddenly everything I thought I knew was wrong.
I'm a human. I do human things. I'd know if
you had to live in the world. Otherwise, how could you learn to be human? Said Susan, as kindly as she could.
And my brother? What about him?
Here it comes, Susan thought. He's not your brother, said Susan. I lied a bit. I'm sorry.
But you said...
I had to lead up to it, said Susan. It's one of those things you have to get hold of a bit at a time, I'm afraid. He's not your brother. He's you.
Then who am I?
Susan sighed. You? Both of you are you.
And there I was, and there she was, said Mrs. Ogg. And out the baby came, no problem there. But that's always a trying moment for the new mum, and there was... She paused, her eyes peering through the windows of memory. Like a feeling that the world had stuttered. And I was holding the baby, and I looked down, and there was me delivering a baby. And I looked at me, and I looked at me, and I remember saying, oh, this is a fine to-do, Mrs. Ogg. And she, who was me, said, you never said a truer word, Mrs. Ogg. And then it all went strange, and there I was, just one of me, holding two babies. Twins, Susan said. Oh, you could call them twins, yes, I suppose you could, said Mrs. Ogg. But I always thought that twins is two little souls born once, not one born twice. Susan waited. Mrs. Ogg looked in the mood to talk. So I said to the man, I said, what now? And he said, is that any business of yours? And I said he could be damn sure it was my business, and he could look me in the eye, and I'd speak my mind to anyone. But I was thinking, you're in trouble now, my girl, 'cause it had all gone mythic. Mythic? Said schoolteacher Susan. Yep, with extra miff. And you can get into big trouble with mythic. But the man just smiled and said, he must be brought up human until he's of age, and I thought, yep, it's gone mythic all right. I could see he hadn't got a clue about what to do next, and it was all going to be down to me. Mrs. Ogg took a suck at her pipe, and her eyes twinkled at Susan through the smoke. I don't know how much experience you have with this sort of thing, my girl, but sometimes when the high and mighty make big plans, they don't always think about the fine detail, right? Yes, I'm a fine detail, Susan thought. One day Death took it into his skull to adopt a motherless child, and I'm a fine detail. She nodded. I thought, how does this go? In a mythic kind of way, Mrs. Ogg went on. I mean... Technically, I could see we're in that area where the prince gets brought up as a swineherd until he manifests his destiny, but there's not that many swineherding jobs around these days, and poking hogs with a stick is not all it's cracked up to be, believe you me. So I said, well, I'd heard the guilds down in the big cities took in foundlings out of charity and looked after them well enough, and there's many well-set-up men and women who started life that way. There's no shame in it. Plus, if the destiny doesn't manifest as per schedule, he'd have set his hands to a good trade, which would be a consolation. Whereas swineherdin's just swineherdin. You're giving me a stern look, miss. Well, yes, it was rather a chilly decision, wasn't it? Someone has to make 'em, said Mrs. Ogg sharply. Besides, I've been around for some time, and I've noticed that them as has it in them to shine will shine through six layers of muck. Whereas those who ain't shiny won't shine, however much you buff 'em. You may think otherwise, but it was me standing there. She investigated the bowl of her pipe with a matchstick. Eventually she went on, and that was it. I would have stayed, of course, because there wasn't so much as a crib in the place, but the man took me aside and said thank you, and that it was time to go. And why would I argue? There was love there. It was in the air. But I won't say that I don't sometimes wonder how it all turned out. I really do.
There were differences, Susan had to admit. Two different lives had indeed burned their unique tracks on the faces. And the selves had been born a second or so apart. And a lot of the universe can change in a second. Think of identical twins, she told herself. But they are two different selves occupying bodies that at least start out identical. They don't start out as identical selves.
He looks quite like me, said Lobsang, and Susan blinked.
She leaned closer to the unconscious form of Jeremy.
Say that again, she said.
I said, he looks quite like me, said Lobsang. Susan glanced at Lady Lejeune, who said,
I saw it too, Susan.
Who saw what? Said Lobsang. What are you hiding from me?
His lips move when you speak, said Susan. They try to form the same words.
He can pick up my thoughts?
It's more complicated than that, I think.
Susan picked up a limp hand and gently pinched the web of skin between thumb and forefinger.
Lobsang winced and glanced at his own hand. A patch of white skin was reddening.
Not just thoughts, said Susan.
This close, you feel his pain. Your speech controls his lips.
Lobsang stared down at Jeremy.
Then what will happen, he said slowly, when he comes round?
I'm wondering the same thing, said Susan.
Perhaps you shouldn't be here.
But this is where I have to be.
We, at least, should not stay here, said Lady Lejeune. I know my kind. They will have been discussing what to do. The signs will not hold them forever. And I have run out of soft centers.
What are you supposed to do when you are where you're supposed to be? Said Susan.
Lobsang reached down and touched Jeremy's hand with his fingertip. The world went white. Susan wondered later if this was what it would be like to be at the heart of a star. It wouldn't be yellow. You wouldn't see fire. There would just be the searing whiteness of every overloaded sense. Screaming all at once.
It faded, gradually, into a mist. The walls of the room appeared, but she could see through them. There were other walls beyond, and other rooms, transparent as ice, and visible only at the corners and where the light caught them. In each one, another Susan was turning to look at her. The rooms went on forever. Susan was sensible. It was, she knew, a major character flaw. It did not make you popular or cheerful, and, this seemed to her to be the most unfair bit, it didn't even make you right. But it did make you definite. And she was definite that what was happening around her was not, in any accepted sense, real. This was not, in itself, a problem. Most of the things humans busied themselves with weren't real either. But sometimes, the mind of the most sensible person encountered something so big, so complex, so alien to all understanding, that it told itself little stories about it instead. Then, when it felt it understood the story, it felt it understood the huge, incomprehensible thing. And this, Susan knew, was her mind telling itself a story. There was a sound like great, heavy metal doors slamming, one after another, getting louder and faster. The universe reached a decision.
The other glass rooms vanished, the walls clouded. Color rose, pastel at first, then darkening, as timeless reality flowed back. The bed was empty. Lobsang had gone, but the air was full of slivers of blue light, turning and swirling like ribbons in a storm. Susan remembered to breathe again.
"Oh," she said aloud.
"Destiny."
She turned. The bedraggled Lady Lejean was still staring at the empty bed.
"Is there another way out of here?"
"There's an elevator at the end of the corridor, Susan, but what happened to..."
"Not Susan," said Susan sharply. "It's Miss Susan. I'm only Susan to my friends, and you are not one of them. I don't trust you at all."
"I don't trust me either," said Lady Lejean meekly.
"Does that help?"
"Show me this elevator, will you?" It turned out to be nothing more than a large box, the size of a small room, that hung from a web of ropes and pulleys in the ceiling. It had been installed recently, by the look of it, to move the large works of art around. Sliding doors occupied most of one wall.
"There are capstans in the cellar for winching it up," said Lady Lejean. "Downward journeys are slowed safely, because of a mechanism by which the weight of the descending elevator causes water to be pumped up into rainwater cisterns on the roof, which in turn can be released back into a hollow counterweight that assists in the elevation of heavier items of..."
"Thank you," said Susan quickly. "But what it really needs, in order to descend, is time." Under her breath she added,
"Can you help?"
The ribbons of blue light orbited her, like puppies anxious to play, and then drifted toward the elevator. "However," she added, "I believe time is on our side now."
Miss Tangerine was amazed at how fast a body learned. Until now, auditors had learned by counting. Sooner or later, everything came down to numbers. If you knew all the numbers, you knew everything. Often the later was a lot later, but that did not matter, because for an auditor, time was just another number. But a brain, a few soggy pounds of gristle, counted numbers so fast that they stopped being numbers at all. She'd been astonished at how easily it could direct a hand to catch a ball in the air, calculating future positions of hand and ball without her even being aware of it. The senses seemed to operate and present her with conclusions before she had time to think. At the moment she was trying to explain to other auditors that not feeding an elephant when there was no elephant not to feed was not, in fact, impossible. Miss Tangerine was one of the faster-learning auditors, and had already formulated a group of things, events, and situations that she categorized as bloody stupid. Things that were bloody stupid could be dismissed. Some of the others were having difficulty understanding this, but now she stopped in mid-harangue when she heard the rumble of the elevator. "Do we have anyone upstairs?" she demanded. The auditors around her shook their heads. "Ignore this sign" had produced too much confusion. "Then someone is coming down," said Miss Tangerine. "They are out of place. They must be stopped." "We must discuss," an auditor began. "Do what I say, you organic organ."
"It's a matter of personalities," said Lady Lejean, as Susan pushed open a door in the roof and stepped out onto the ledge.
"Yes," said Susan, looking around at the silent city.
"I thought you didn't have them."
"They will have them now," said Lady Lejean, climbing out behind her.
"And personalities define themselves in terms of other personalities."
Susan, prowling along the parapet, considered this strange statement.
"You mean there will be flaming rows?" she said.
"Yes. We never had egos before."
"Well, you seem to be managing."
"Only by becoming completely and utterly insane,"
said her ladyship. Susan turned. Lady Lejeune's hat and dress had become even more tattered, and she was shedding sequins. The journey through the museum had done nothing at all for her makeup, either.
You don't look insane, lied Susan.
As such?
Oh, thank you. But sanity is defined by the majority, I'm afraid. Do you know the saying, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts?
Of course. Susan scanned the rooftops for a way down. She did not need this. The thing seemed to want to talk, or rather chatter aimlessly.
It is an insane statement. It is a nonsense, but now I believe that it is true.
Good. That elevator should be getting down about now.
Slivers of blue light, like trout slipping through a stream, danced around the elevator door. The auditors gathered. They had been learning. Many of them had acquired weapons, and a number of them had taken care not to communicate to the others that gripping something offensive in the hand seemed a very natural thing to do. It spoke to something right down in the back of the brain. It was therefore unfortunate that when a couple of them pulled open the elevator door, it was to reveal, slightly melting in the middle of the floor, a cherry liqueur chocolate. The scent wafted. There was only one survivor, and when Miss Tangerine ate the chocolate, there wasn't even that.
One of life's little certainties, said Susan, standing on the edge of the museum's parapet, is that there is generally a last chocolate hidden in all those empty wrappers. Then she reached down and grabbed the top of a drainpipe. She wasn't certain how this would work, if she fell. But would she fall? There was no time to fall. Well, she had her own personal time. In theory, if anything so definite as a theory existed in a case like this, that meant she could just drift down to the ground. But the time to test a theory like that was when you had no other choice. A theory was just an idea, but a drainpipe was a fact. The blue light flickered around her hands.
Lobsang, she said quietly, it is you, isn't it?
That name is as good as any for us. The voice was as faint as a breath. This may seem a stupid question, but where are you?
We are just a memory, and I am weak.
Oh. Susan slid a little further.
But I will grow strong. Get to the clock.
What's the point? There was nothing we could do.
Times have changed.
Susan reached the ground. Lady Lejeune followed, moving clumsily. Her evening dress had acquired several more tears.
May I offer a fashion tip? Said Susan.
It would be welcomed, said her ladyship politely.
Long cerise bloomers with that dress?
Not a good idea.
No. Well, they are very colorful and quite warm. What should I have chosen instead?
With that cut? Practically nothing.
That would have been acceptable.
Susan blanched at the thought of unfolding the complex laws of lingerie to someone who wasn't even, she felt, anybody.
To anyone likely to find out, yes,
she finished.
It would take too long to explain.
Lady Lejeune sighed.
Oh, all of it does, she said. Even clothing. Skin substitutes to preserve body heat? So simple.
So easy to say.
But there are so many rules and exceptions, impossible to understand.
Susan looked along Broad Way. It was thick with silent traffic, but there was no sign of an auditor.
"We'll run into more of them," she said aloud.
"Yes, there will be hundreds at least," said Lady Lejeune.
"Why?"
"Because we have always wondered what life is like."
"Then let's get up into Zephyr Street," said Susan.
"What is there for us?"
"Wienrich and Botcher."
"Who are they?"
"I think the original Herr Wienrich and Frau Botcher died a long time ago, but the shop still does very good business," said Susan, darting across the street.
"We need ammunition."
Lady Lejeune caught up.
"Oh, they make chocolate," she said.
"Does a bear poo in the woods?" said Susan, and realized her mistake straight away.
"Teaching small children for any length of time can do this to a vocabulary."
"Too late." Lady Lejeune looked thoughtful for a moment.
"Yes," she said at last. "Yes, I do believe that most varieties do, indeed, excrete, as you suggest, at least in the temperate zones, but there are several that..."
"I meant to say, yes, they make chocolate," said Susan.
"Vanity, vanity," thought Lutzer, as the milk cart rattled through the silent city. "Ronnie would have been like a god, and people of that stripe don't like hiding. Not really hiding. They like to leave a little clue, some emerald tablet somewhere, some code in some tomb under the desert, something to say to the keen researcher, 'I was here, I was great.' What else had the first people been afraid of? Night, maybe? Cold, bears, winter, stars, the endless sky, spiders, snakes, one another. People had been afraid of so many things." He reached into his pack for the battered copy of The Way and opened it at random. Koan 97. "Do unto otters as you would have them do unto you." No real help there. Besides, he'd occasionally been unsure that he'd written that one down properly, although it certainly had worked. He'd always left aquatic mammals well alone, and they had done the same to him. He tried again. Koan 124. "It's amazing what you see if you keep your eyes open."
"What's the book, Monk?" said Ronnie.
"Oh, just a little book," said Lutzer. He looked around. The cart was passing a funeral parlour. The owner had invested in a large plate-glass window, even though the professional undertaker does not in truth have that much to sell that looks good in a window, and they usually make do with dark, sombre drapes and perhaps a tasteful urn. "And the name of the fifth horseman." "Ah," said Lutzer quietly.
"Something funny, Monk?"
"Obvious when you think about it," said Lutzer, as much to himself as to Ronnie. Then he turned in his seat and stuck out his hand.
"Pleased to meet you," he said. "Let me guess your name." And said it.
Susan had been unusually inexact. To call Wienrich and Botcher chocolate makers was like calling Leonard of Quirum a decent painter who also tinkered with things, or Death, not someone you'd want to meet every day. It was accurate, but it didn't tell the whole story. For one thing, they didn't make, they created. There's an important difference.
"Up to $10 a pound, usually."
And while their select little shop sold the results, it didn't do anything so crass as to fill the window with them. That would suggest, well, over-eagerness. Generally, W&B had a display of silk and velvet drapes with, on a small stand, perhaps one of their special pralines, or no more than three of their renowned frosted caramels. There was no price tag. If you had to ask the price of W&B's chocolates, you couldn't afford them. And if you'd tasted one and still couldn't afford them, you'd save and scrimp and rob and sell elderly members of your family for just one more of those mouthfuls that fell in love with your tongue and turned your soul to whipped cream. There was a discreet drain in the pavement in case people standing in front of the window drooled too much. Wienrich and Botcher were, naturally, foreigners, and according to Ankh-Morpork's Guild of Confectioners, they did not understand the peculiarities of the city's taste buds. Ankh-Morpork people, said the guild, were hearty, no-nonsense folk who did not want chocolate that was stuffed with cocoa liquor, and were certainly not like effete, la-di-da foreigners who wanted cream in everything. In fact, they actually preferred chocolate made mostly from milk, sugar, suet, hooves, lips, miscellaneous squeezings, rat droppings, plaster, flies, tallow, bits of tree, hair, lint, spiders, and powdered cocoa husks. This meant that, according to the food standards of the great chocolate centers in Borogravia and Quirum, Ankh-Morpork chocolate was formerly classed as cheese, and only escaped, through being the wrong color, being defined as tile grout. Susan allowed herself one of their cheaper boxes per month, and she could easily stop at the first layer, if she wanted to. You needn't come in, she said, as she opened the shop door. Rigid customers lined the counter. Please call me Miria. I don't think I... Please, said Lady Lejeune meekly. A name is important. Suddenly, in spite of everything, Susan felt a brief pang of sympathy for the creature. Oh, very well. Miria, you needn't come in. I can stand it. But I thought chocolate was a raging temptation, said Susan, being firm with herself. It is. They stared up at the shelves behind the counter. Miria. Miria, said Susan, speaking only some of her thoughts aloud. From the Ephesian word Myrios, meaning innumerable, and Lejeune as a crude pun of legion. Oh, dear. We thought a name should say what a thing is, said her ladyship. And there is safety in numbers. I'm sorry. Well, these are their basic assortments, said Susan, dismissing the shop display with a wave of her hand. Let's try the back room. Are you all right? I'm fine, murmured Lady Lejeune, swaying. You're not going to pig out on me, are you? I know about willpower. The body craves the chocolate, but the mind does not. At least, so I tell myself. And it must be true. The mind can overrule the body. Otherwise, what is it for? I've often wondered, said Susan, pushing open another door. Ah, the magician's cave. Magic? They used magic here? Nearly right. Lady Lejeune leaned on the doorframe for support when she saw the tables. Oh, she said. Oh, I can detect sugar, milk, butter, cream, vanilla, hazelnuts, almonds, walnuts, raisins, orange peel, various liqueurs, citrus pectin, strawberries, raspberries, essence of violets, cherries, pineapples, pistachios, oranges, limes, lemons, coffee, cocoa. Nothing there to be frightened of, right? Said Susan, surveying the workshop for useful weaponry. Cocoa is just a rather bitter bean, after all.
Yes, but...
Lady Lejeune clenched her fists, shut her eyes, and bared her teeth.
Put them all together, and they make...
Steady, steady. The will can overrule the emotions. The will can overrule the instincts, the auditor chanted. Good, good. Now just work your way up to the bit where it says chocolate, okay?
That's the hard one.
In fact, it seemed to Susan, as she walked past the vats and counters, that chocolate lost some of its attraction when you saw it like this. It was the difference between seeing the little heaps of pigment and seeing the whole picture. She selected a syringe that seemed designed to do something intensely personal to female elephants, although she decided that here it was probably used for doing the wiggly bits of decoration. And over here was a small vat of cocoa liquor. She stared around at the trays and trays of fondant cremes, marzipans, and caramels. Oh, and here was an entire table of soul cake eggs. But these weren't the hollow-shelled, cardboard-tasting presents for children. Oh, no. These were the confectionery equivalent of fine, intricate jewelry. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw movement. One of the statue-like workers bent over her tray of praline dreams was shifting almost imperceptibly. Time was flowing into the room. Pale blue light glinted in the air. She turned and saw a vaguely human figure hovering beside her. It was featureless and as transparent as mist, but in her head it said, "I'm stronger. You are my anchor, my link to this world. Can you guess how hard it is to find it again in so many?" "Get me to the clock." Susan turned and thrust the icing syringe into the arms of the groaning Miria. "Grab that and make some kind of sling or something. I want you to be carrying as many of those chocolate eggs as possible. And the cremes, and the liqueurs. Understand? You can do it." Oh, gods, there was no alternative. The poor thing needed some kind of morale boost. "Please, Miria? And that's a stupid name. You're not many, you're one, okay? Just be yourself." "Unity. That'd be a good name." The new Unity raised a mascara-streaked face. "Yes, it is. It's a good name." Susan snatched as much merchandise as she could carry, aware of some rustling behind her, and turned to find Unity standing to attention, holding, by the look of it, a bench worth of assorted confectionery in a sort of big, cerise sack. "Oh, good. Intelligent use of the materials at hand," said Susan weakly. Then the teacher within her cut in and added, "I hope you brought enough for everybody."
"You were the first," said Lutzer. "You basically created the whole business. Innovative you were." "That was then," said Ronnie Soak. "It's all changed now." "Not like it used to be," agreed Lutzer. "Take death," said Ronnie Soak. "Impressive, I grant you. And who doesn't look good in black? But after all, death. What's death?" "Just a big sleep," said Lutzer. "Just a big sleep," said Ronnie Soak. "As for the others, war? War's so bad. Why do people keep doing it?" "Practically a hobby," said Lutzer. He began to roll himself a cigarette. "Practically a hobby," repeated Ronnie Soap. As for famine and pestilence, well...
Enough said, said Lutzer, sympathetically.
Exactly. I mean, famine's a fearful thing, obviously, in an agricultural community, but you've got to move with the times,
said Lutzer, putting the roll up in his mouth.
You put your finger right on it. You've got to move with the times. I mean, does your average city person fear famine?
No. He thinks food grows in shops, said Lutzer. He was beginning to enjoy this. He had 800 years' worth of experience in steering the thoughts of his superiors, and most of them had been intelligent. He decided to strike out a little.
Fire? Now city folk really fear fire, he said. That's new. Your primitive villager, he reckoned fire was a good thing, didn't he? Kept the wolves away. If it burned down his hut, well, logs and turf are cheap enough. But now he lives in a street of crowded wooden houses, and everyone's cooking in their rooms. Well...
Ronnie glared.
Fire? Fire? Just a demigod. Some little runt of a thief pinches the flame from the gods and suddenly he's immortal. You call that training and experience?
A spark leapt from his fingers and ignited the end of Lutzer's cigarette.
And as for gods, only come lately's a pack of them, said Lutzer quickly. Right, people started worshipping them because they were afraid of me, said Ronnie. Did you know that?
No, really? Said Lutzer innocently. But now Ronnie sagged.
That was then, of course, he said. It's different now. I'm not what I used to be.
No, no, obviously not, no, said Lutzer soothingly.
But it's all a matter of how you look at it, am I correct? Now, supposing a man, that is to say a anthropomorphic personification, said Ronnie Soap. But I've always preferred the term avatar.
Lutzi's brow wrinkled. You fly around a lot, he said.
That would be aviator.
Oh, sorry.
Well, supposing an avatar, thank you, who was perhaps a bit ahead of his time thousands of years ago, well, supposing he took a good look around now, he might just find the world is ready for him again.
Lutzer waited.
My abbot, though, he reckons you are the bee's knees,
he said for a little reinforcement.
Does he? Said Ronnie Soak suspiciously. Bee's knees, cat's pyjamas, and dog's elbows.
Lutzer finished.
He's written scrolls and scrolls about you. Says you are hugely important in understanding how the universe works. Yeah, but he's just one man, said Ronnie Soak,
with all the sullenness and reluctance of someone cuddling a lifetime's huge snit like a favourite soft toy.
Technically, yes, said Lutzer. But he's an abbot, and brainy. He thinks such big thoughts he needs a second lifetime just to finish them off. Let a lot of peasants fear famine, I say, but someone like you should aim for quality. And you look at the cities now. Back in the old days, there were just heaps of mud bricks with names like Ur and Ah and Ug. These days, there's millions of people living in cities. Very, very complicated cities. Just you think about what they really, really fear. And fear? Well, fear is belief, hmm?
There was another long pause.
Well, all right, but...
Ronnie began.
Of course they won't be living in them very long, because by the time the grey people have finished taking them to pieces to see how they work, there won't be any belief left. My customers... do depend on me,
Ronnie Soak mumbled.
What customers? That's Soak speaking, said Lutzer. That's not the voice of Chaos.
Ha, said Chaos bitterly.
You haven't told me yet how you worked that one out.
Because I've got more than 3 brain cells and you're vain and you painted your actual name back to front on your cart whether you knew it or not. And a dark window is a mirror, and K and S are still recognizable in a reflection even when they're back to front, thought Lutze. But that wasn't a good way forward.
I was obvious, he said. You sort of shine through. It's like putting a sheet over an elephant. You might not be able to see it, but you're sure the elephant's still there.
Chaos looked wretched.
I don't know, he said. It's been a long time. Oh, and I thought you said you were number one, said Lutza, deciding on a new approach. Sorry, still, I suppose it's not your fault that you've lost a few skills over the centuries, what with one thing and lost skills, snapped Kale, waving a finger under the sweeper's nose. I could certainly take you to the cleaners, you little maggot.
What with a dangerous yogurt? Said Lutzer, climbing off the cart. Chaos leapt down after him.
Where do you get off talking to me like that? He demanded.
Lutzer glanced up.
Corner of Merchant and Broadway, he said.
So what? Chaos roared. He tore off his striped apron and his white cap. He seemed to grow in size. Darkness evaporated off him like smoke. Lutzer folded his hands and grinned.
Remember Rule One, he said. Rules! Rules! I'm Chaos!
Who was the first? Said Lutzer.
Yes, creator and destroyer. Right. Apparently complicated, apparently passionless behavior that nevertheless has a simple, deterministic explanation and is a key to new levels of understanding in a multidimensional universe? You better believe it. What? Got to move with the times, mister! Got to keep up!
Shouted Lutzer excitedly, hopping from foot to foot.
You're what people think you are, and they've changed you. I hope you're good at sums. You can't tell me what to be, Chaos roared. I'm Chaos!
You don't think so?
Well, your big comeback ain't gonna happen now that the auditors are taken over. They're rules, mister. That's what they are. They're the cold, dead rules.
Silver lightning flickered in the walking cloud that had once been Ronnie. Then cloud, cart, and horse vanished.
Well, could have been worse, I suppose, said Lutzer to himself. Not a very bright lad, really. Possibly a bit too old-fashioned.
He turned around and found a crowd of auditors watching him. There were dozens of them. He sighed and grinned his sheepish little grin. He'd had just about enough for one day.
Well, I expect you've heard of Rule One, right? He said.
That seemed to give them pause. One said, we know millions of rules, human.
Billions, trillions, said another.
Well, you can't attack me, said Lutzer, cause of Rule One.
The nearest auditors went into a huddle. It must involve gravitation.
No, quantum effects, obviously.
Logically, there cannot be a Rule One, because at that point there would be no concept of plurality. But if there is not a Rule One, can there be any other rules? If there is no Rule One, where is Rule Two?
There are millions of rules. They cannot fail to be numbered.
Wonderful, thought Lutzer. All I have to do is wait until their heads explode. But an auditor stepped forward. It looked more wild-eyed than the others, and was much more unkempt. It was also carrying an axe.
We do not have to discuss this, it snapped. We must think. This is nonsense. We will not discuss it.
But what is rule?
An auditor began.
You will call me Mr. White.
Mr. White, what is Rule One?
I'm not glad you asked that question,
screamed Mr. White, and swung the axe. The body of the other auditor crumbled in around the blade, dissolving into floating motes that dispersed in a fine cloud.
Anyone else got any questions?
Said Mr. White, raising the axe again. One or two auditors, not yet entirely in tune with current developments, opened their mouths to speak, and shut them again. Lutzer took a few steps back. He prided himself on an incredibly well-honed ability to talk his way in or out of anything. But that rather depended on a passably sane entity being involved at the other end of the dialogue. Mr. White turned to Lutzer.
What are you doing out of your place, organic?
But Lutzer was overhearing another whispered conversation. It was coming from the other side of a nearby wall, and it went like this.
Who cares about the damn wording?
Accuracy is important, Susan. There is a precise description on the little map inside the lid. Look.
And you think that will impress anyone? Please, things should be done properly. Oh, give it to me, then.
Mr. White advanced on Lutzer, axe raised.
It is forbidden to...
he began.
Eat, oh, good grief, eat! A delicious fondant sugar cream infused with delightfully rich and creamy raspberry filling wrapped in mysterious dark chocolate, you grey bastards!
A shower of small objects pattered down the street. Several of them broke open. Lutzer heard a whine, or rather the silence caused by the absence of a whine he'd grown used to.
Oh, no, I'm winding down.
Trailing smoke, but looking more like a milkman again, albeit one that had just delivered to a blazing house, Ronnie Soak stormed into his dairy.
Who does he think he is? He muttered,
gripping the spotless edge of the counter so hard that the metal bent. Ha! Oh, yes, they just toss you aside, but when they want you to make a comeback... Under his fingers, the metal went white hot and then dripped. I've got customers. I've got customers. People depend on me. Might not be a glamorous job, but people will always need milk. He clapped a hand to his forehead. Where the molten metal touched his skin, the metal evaporated. The headache was really bad. He could remember the time when there was only him. It was hard to remember because there was nothing. No color, no sound, no pressure, no time, no spin, no light, no life. Just chaos. And the thought arose, do I want that again? The perfect order that goes with changelessness? More thoughts were following that one, like little silvery eels in his mind. He was, after all, a horseman. And had been ever since the time the people in mud cities on baking plains put together some hazy idea of something that had existed before anyone else. And a horseman picks up the noises of the world. The mud city people and the skin tent people, they'd known instinctively that the world swirled perilously through a complex and uncaring multiverse. That life was lived a mirror's thickness from the cold of space and the gulfs of night. They knew that everything they called reality, the web of rules that made life happen, was a bubble on the tide. They feared old chaos. But now... He opened his eyes and looked down at his dark, smoking hands. To the world in general, he said... Who am I now?
Lutzer heard his voice speed up from nothing. No, you're wound up again, said a young woman in front of him. She stood back, giving him a critical look. Lutzer, for the first time in 800 years, felt that he'd been caught doing something wrong. It was that kind of expression, searching, rummaging around inside his head. You'll be Lutzer, then. Said Susan. I'm Susan Stohelit. No time for explanations. You've been out for, well, not for long. We have to get Lobsang to the glass clock. Are you any good? Lobsang thinks you're a bit of a fraud. Only a bit. I'm surprised. Lutzer looked around. What happened here? The street was empty, except for the ever-present statue. But scraps of silver paper and coloured wrappers littered the ground, and across the wall behind him was a long splash of what looked very much like chocolate icing. Some of them got away, said Susan, picking up what Lutzer could only hope was a giant icing syringe. Mostly they fought with one another. Would you try to tear someone apart just for a coffee cream? Lutzer looked into those eyes. After 800 years, you learn how to read people. And Susan was a story that went back a very long way. She probably even knew about Rule 1 and didn't care. This was someone to treat with respect, but you couldn't let even someone like her have it all her own way. Well, the kind with a coffee bean on top or the ordinary kind, he said. The kind without the coffee bean, I think, said Susan, holding his gaze. No. No, I don't think I would, said Lutzer. But they are learning, said a woman's voice behind the sweeper. Some resisted. We can learn. That's how humans became humans. Lutzer regarded the speaker. She looked like a society lady
who had just had a really bad day in a threshing machine. "Can I just be clear here?" he said, staring from one woman to the other. "You've been fighting the grey people with chocolate?"
"Yes," said Susan, peering around the corner. "It's a sensory explosion. They lose control of their morphic field."
"Can you throw it all?"
"Good. Unity, give him as many chocolate eggs as he can carry. The secret is to get them to land hard so there's lots of shrapnel."
"And where is Lobsang?" said Lutzer.
"Him? You could say he is with us in spirit."
There were blue sparkles in the air. "Growing pains, I think," Susan added. Centuries of experience once again came to Lutzer's aid.
"He always looked like a lad who needed to find himself," he said.
"Yes, and it came as a bit of a shock. Let's go."
Death looked down at the world. Timelessness had reached the rim now and was expanding into the universe at the speed of light. The disc world was a sculpture in crystal. Not an apocalypse. There had always been plenty of those. Small apocalypses, not the full shilling at all. Fake apocalypses. Apocryphal apocalypses. Most of them had been back in the old days when the world, as in end of the world, was often objectively no wider than a few villages and a clearing in the forest. And those little worlds had ended, but there had always been somewhere else. There had been the horizon to start with. The fleeing refugees would find that the world was bigger than they'd thought. A few villages in a clearing? Ha! How could they have been so stupid? Now they knew it was a whole island. Of course, there was that horizon again. The world had run out of horizons. As Death watched, the sun stopped in its orbit, and its light became duller, redder. He sighed and nudged Binky. The horse stepped forward in a direction that could not be found on any map. And the sky was full of gray shapes. There was a ripple in the ranks of auditors as the pale horse trotted forward. One drifted toward Death and hung in the air a few feet away. It said, "Should you not be riding out? Do you speak for all?" "You know the custom," said the voice in Death's mind. "Among us one speaks for all. What is being done is wrong. It is not your business. Nevertheless, we are all answerable." "The universe will last forever," said the voice. "Everything preserved, ordered, understood, lawful, filed, changeless. A perfect world. Finished? No. It will all end one day in any case. But this is too soon. There is unfinished business. And that is everything." And with a flash of light, a figure clothed all in white appeared, holding a book in one hand. It looked from Death to the endlessly massing ranks of the auditors and said, "Sorry, is this the right place?"
Two auditors were measuring the number of atoms in a paving slab. It existed, and therefore it had to be measured. They looked up at a movement. "Good afternoon," said Lutzer. "May I draw your attention to the notice my assistant is holding up?" Susan held up the sign. It read, "Mouths must be open, by order." And Lutzer unfolded his hands. There was a caramel in each one, and he was a good shot. The mouths shut, the faces went impassive. Then there was a sound somewhere between a purr and a wail, which disappeared into the ultrasonic. And then the auditors dissolved, gently, first going fuzzy around the edges, and as the process accelerated, swiftly becoming a spreading cloud. "Hand to mouth fighting," said Lutzer. "Why doesn't it happen to humans?"
"It nearly does," said Susan, and when they stared at her, she blinked and said, "They're stupid, indulgent humans, anyway."
"You don't have to concentrate to stay the same shape," said Unity. "And that was the last of the caramels, by the way."
"No, there's six in one of the B&W's gold selections," said Susan. "Three have got white chocolate cream in dark chocolate, and three have got whipped cream in milk chocolate. They're the ones in the silver wrap. Look,
I just happen to know things, all right? Let's keep going, okay? Without mentioning chocolate.